From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America, our topic on this edition of the program, Top Global Risks in 2023. Our guest, Cliff Kupchan. He's chairman of the Eurasia Group, a firm which is considered a leader in political risk analysis with offices around the world. In their annual report, Forecasting the Most Serious Geopolitical Challenges for 2023, Eurasia Group chairman and co-author Cliff Kupchan makes an interesting observation, quote, dictatorships are stumbling at the same time they're becoming more consolidated, and adds that the United States has emerged as the world's sole global military leader in light of Russia's failed war against Ukraine. On the other hand, Kupchan and co-author Eurasia Group President Ian Bremmer assert that America is not leading by example when it comes to exporting democracy, which it did after the fall of the Berlin Wall. In fact, they argue that the United States is now the leading exporter of tools that undermine democracy. In addition to the social media platforms, which use algorithms that polarize society but maximize profits, the recent attack on Brazil's democratic institutions by supporters of the defeated former president Jair Bolsonaro were eerily reminiscent of the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, by extremist supporters of former President Donald Trump, illustrating that political violence is being exported as well. In their 2023 Global Risk Report, Kupchan and Bremmer refer to rogue Russia and maximum Xi to underscore threats by the Kremlin and Beijing. They also warn about Iran, which faces a hostile geopolitical environment, as well as domestic unrest in the form of massive nationwide women-led protests, which represent the most serious risk to the Islamic Republic's authority since the 1979 revolution. We will talk about this and much more with Eurasia Group Chairman Cliff Kupchan, who is also director of the firm's research. Before joining Eurasia Group, Cliff held senior positions at the U.S. State Department during the Clinton administration. He also worked for the House of Representatives International Relations Committee, where he served as the top foreign policy advisor on global foreign assistance, North Africa, and Eurasia. He was also the staff director of the Subcommittee on Africa. And Cliff Kupchan joins us via Zoom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Cliff, let me ask you, before we get into, you know, the 10 different top risks or some of them, what is your top line takeaway regarding the risks that you and Ian Bremmer outline that face us in 2023? Which of the 10 do you think we should worry about most?
Well, the top line broad takeaway is that a small number of men have way too much power. They're not well informed and they're not going to make good decisions. That starts with the one that we should worry about the most, which is Russia. Rogue Russia, Vladimir Putin, made the worst decision that I know of in the last few decades with his invasion of Ukraine. And that leads into what I think is the thing I worry about the most.
So let's get right to what you characterize as rogue Russia. Talk about the implications of this most unfortunate and regrettable decision by Vladimir Putin to invade a neighbor that he doesn't consider a sovereign state clearly, but which it is. Talk about, especially where we are today, given the robust support by the United States and the Transatlantic Alliance and others to sustain Ukraine and combat Russia. What are the implications of a rogue Russia in 2023?
Well, where we are is in a very dangerous place for a number of reasons. Let me just mention that, you know, I talked to a lot of my friends in Moscow, and they're still my friends. There's a real feeling there's no interest in talking diplomacy there, very little interest in Washington either. But neither side is interested in talking right now, which is never a good thing. And secondly, I think, you know, many of these guys, maybe accurately, think that they're going to be perceived as war criminals or pursued as war criminals. And that even increases their risk acceptance even more than one might think. So I think the view from Moscow is very important. It's something of a dead-ender syndrome that they have very little to lose from going for it. Real commitment to the war still, which in part informs our view that Russia will turn to asymmetric warfare this year, meaning retaliation and warfare, but not on the battlefield. Other ways of doing it. The model for this, the ones who wrote the textbook, are Iran, obviously, using cyber terrorism and other means to pursue their goal of upending the stability of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Gulf, whatever you want to call it. Russia will turn to nuclear threats, blackmail, turn to cyber attacks on institutions, European institutions, possibly fiber optics cables, possibly shoot at Western satellites. There's a whole range of things that are very dangerous that I think Mr. Putin will do because he feels he's fighting NATO. He's fighting two wars. This is very important to understand, I think, from the Russian perspective. The Russians are fighting both NATO and Ukraine, and they will pursue those two wars next year.
Well, that is a very ominous prediction, and I guess we'll just have to see how things play out. Let's move on now to what you characterize as maximum Xi. So China, we haven't seen a leader like Xi Jinping since probably Mao Zedong. He really consolidated his power in the 20th Party Congress last year, flip-flopped on COVID. What are your thoughts regarding the threat emanating from China?
You know, maximum Xi has gone from zero COVID to maximum COVID. He's flipped on a dime on an issue that we all thought was a bellwether badge of honor for him. Few deaths, mocking Western democracies for their hundreds of thousands of deaths. Well, this decision could result in well over a million Chinese deaths, some of which could have been prevented by reopening in a more controlled, planned, thought-out way. But what does that show? That shows that, you're right, like Mao Zedong, he's really consolidated power. But unlike Mao Zedong, he runs a country with the second largest global economy and a military like the U.S. had maybe three decades ago, but a lot of power, both economic and military. And when you take a gentleman who is that powerful and is as poorly advised in all probability, no checks and balances, no firm view on our part that he's getting good expert opinion, given his recent appointments at the 20th Party Congress, loaded with his acolytes. So we're going to see a lot more policy volatility out of Xi Jinping. He's shown an ability to turn on a dime. We think, given the quality of the advice he's getting, we'll see more of that kind of decision-making, especially in the economic sector, which is going to be looking for a huge rebound after poor performance during COVID. That is the main risk. It's mostly an economic risk that under Xi's stewardship, the Chinese economy will perform less well than many pundits and investors are counting on it to perform in 2023. That's the risk.
And with regard to the so-called no limits friendship with Russia, what do you see perhaps happening between Russia and China as Russia continues to lash out against the West, not really concede on Ukraine? Could China play a potentially positive role by not backing Russia? How do you see that?
They could, but you know, in my discussions with the Chinese, they're very uncomfortable with Russia's position, but the overriding interest to sort of balance U.S. power as they see it prevails. So I think they're still loyal, but very uncomfortable in the relationship. Where it would get more telling is if Putin was edging towards a nuclear use. Then I think it's more likely that Xi Jinping would say, stop, don't do that. You can't do that. I'm not sure at all that would stop Putin if he was desperate enough to consider nuclear weapons. But that's where I think that the Chinese voice could become central to how this unfolds.
I'd like now to turn to what you call Iran in a corner, because, you know, what we witnessed in Iran in 2022, the massive uprising led by women, which turned into, after the headscarf issue, basically an anti-regime and a nationwide protest against the regime. How has that affected the regime itself and the way it behaves? And why is it so threatening for 2023?
Well, first of all, the tragic death of Mahsa Amini really did shake the Iranian population very deeply. It was both, I think, a genuine outpouring of grief and an outpouring of pent-up frustrations about quality of life and lack of freedom. I've been to Iran many times. It's an astoundingly amazing country run by a government that we have in this country very serious disagreements with. The risk is that the protests, the nuclear program, and Iran's new tie-up with Russia will stoke tensions already high to even higher levels with the West. Sympathy from the West for the protesters, if not support, not tangible support that I know of, but at least, you know, strong backing rhetorically. The nuclear program, Iran's breakout time, enough time to acquire a bomb's worth of enriched uranium, is about 3 weeks now. It's really crazy low. And the tie-up with Putin will probably produce more sanctions from the U.S. and from the EU, I would think. The biggest risk, I think, Iran came very close last December to attacking Saudi infrastructure again, like they did in Upcake several years ago. That led to scrambling of U.S. jets and a stand down of the crisis. Iran blaming the Saudis for fanning the protests, I think, is the biggest regional risk going forward. Though on the nuclear front, Israel will continue to, without attribution, sabotage Iranian nuclear facilities. But let me add, the risk with Iran that I worry about the most, everything we write in the report has to be probable. The one I worry about the most isn't probable, but I do worry about it a lot. It's that, the Supreme Leader passes. He's not in good health. That the Revolutionary Guard, this sort of ideological separate army in Iran, makes a play for power and either succeeds in gaining power or making the Supreme Leader position more ceremonial, and does try to do some of the metals work that is the gap between Iran and a functioning nuclear weapon. Not probable, but if that comes off, then this will be a really, really severe crisis. So that's how I see Iran more broadly.
We'll have more in just a minute, but first, you are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Eurasia Group Chairman Cliff Kupchan. We're discussing the firm's report on the top risks of 2023. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol_Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a new Facebook fan, Maruf Sadat, a Turkish businessman currently residing in Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Turning back to our guest, Cliff Kupchan, he is the chairman of the Eurasia Group. Cliff, before we went to a break, we were talking about Iran, Russia, of course, China. I'd like now to turn to what you and Ian Bremmer call weapons of mass disruption as another risk that we're facing in 2023. As you mentioned in the report, the United States used to be, an exporter of democracy when the Berlin Wall came down. And now we're seeing the United States, in a sense, being an exporter of tools that undermine democracy. And we saw recently, in Brazil, another example of the export of political violence that we saw here in the United States on January 6, 2021. But talk about these tools that undermine democracy that the U.S. seems to be exporting.
The U.S.'s greatest, so many great things about the country, in my view. One of the U.S.'s greatest attributes is its technological ingenuity, symbolized by Silicon Valley. It exists in Silicon Valley, but it also is present in so many other startup and hubs around universities and even elsewhere. The game changer that we see is generative AI, GPT-3, GPT-4 to come out this year. If any of our friends listening have not downloaded, played around with GPT-3, I highly recommend it. It's just absolutely astounding. In fact, the name, Weapons of Disruption, we plugged in, we wanted right about, and that's where the name came from, GPT-3. It is a sea change to our mind. We have a really good geotechnology team here. The power of AI to do images, to create texts, code, to do a whole range of things that press the boundaries of technology in new directions. And the threshold we think we've passed this year is the generative AI passes the Turing test, that you don't know whether you're dealing with a human or a machine. And that's pretty powerful stuff. The implications for politics are many. Populists, demagogues around the world will be able to use this function to set up armies of bots, to elevate fringe candidates around in their countries. Authoritarian leaders, Putin, Xi Jinping, Putin to undermine Western democracy, Xi Jinping to clamp down even tighter on his own country. And even business, which is what we deal with is our core business here. A deep fake that compromises a key CEO could wipe millions, if not billions, off a market cap is really quite astounding. Or the speed with which and the accuracy with which generative AI can manipulate information could throw off sentiment-based investment strategies. You get fake sentiment out there. And investors that are investing good people's money in good faith will be dealing with bad information. So this is talk about disruptive technology. This, in the political sphere, has the potential to be extremely disruptive. And that's how we get to our number three risk, weapons of mass disruption.
It's a fascinating explanation.
It's a great one, right?
And something like you said, where technology meant for good can certainly be used for very nefarious and malign purposes and very dangerous. Let's move now to arrested global development. I'd like you to talk about that, particularly many of our listeners are from sub-Saharan Africa, around the developing world. I'd like you to talk about what you mean by that.
What we mean is that human development indicators have been on a long upward trajectory. You get data from the 70s, data from the 90s, that the narrative, which is, there's a lot to it, though it's got drawbacks, but that free trade around the world led to the growing and expanding global middle class, that in turn led to better education, better literacy, more opportunities for women, a range of improving human development indicators year after year after year. That has stopped. UN data shows that development indicators for most countries dropped in 2021 and 2022. And that's a big change. So that, to my mind, what I call the triple shock, the pandemic, the war, and the inflation shock, have taken a real toll, especially on emerging markets or developing countries. There's kind of a K-shaped phenomenon in every country, which means that the recovery and the status from these shocks of the poorer people are hit much harder than the richer people. That's one element of it. Food security will continue to be hit, I should say, by high energy prices, high fertilizer prices, higher input prices across the board for farmers, by tariffs in the food security sector that will turn this into a less globalized sector than it used to be, temporary tariffs that will remain permanent. So on a range of fronts, and there's one more important one, which is what we call West-South tensions. The disparity between the advanced industrialized democracies and the global South will grow and are growing. And in closing on this risk, there's really one wedge issue that I worry about a lot, is that much of the global South complains and feels strongly that they are paying the price for Western sanctions over a war that they are not a party to. That there is, I think, revulsion among most of my colleagues in the global South over the killing that's going on. But there are lots of other wars in their view that also had killing. And they don't want to pay the price in terms of higher energy prices, in part caused by Western sanctions. I think that's something that's a real challenge for U.S. messaging and for U.S. diplomats, to explain just why Vladimir Putin's war threatens everybody, if indeed it becomes a precedent for the subversion of a democracy by force, by taking of land again by force. But I want to acknowledge that dilemma that we in this country as Americans at any rate face. So that's arrested global development, Carol.
Very well said. And as always, women and girls, you know, suffer the most, losing their rights and gender equality being rolled back.
Especially as we kicked into the informal sector, I would say. Everything goes up exponentially as far as sexual exploitation, forced child marriages, all the things that I think we saw some progress in until recent trends would indicate otherwise. So those that are hit hardest prominently include women and girls.
Exactly. It's just another reason why this war that Vladimir Putin started, you know, has to end sooner than later. And like you said, messaging has to be very well developed, because, you know, it is flowing from it are these unfortunate implications. But let me get you now to weigh in on, well, since we're talking about energy and costs, what about the energy crunch? What would you like to say about that particular risk?
We think that energy prices are going to be higher than most people do this year. That oil demand, because of rising demand in China, now significantly rising demand, given that they're going to climb out of zero COVID so quickly. Oil demand will be high, and supply, because Russian production under sanctions will slowly decline, is going to be tight. Similar story on the gas side, where competition for Norwegian and North African gas will be high, and for LNG will be high. What I'd like to say there is that some global South countries will be priced out of the LNG market, especially in Southeast Asia. And these involve some of the poorest countries in the world. So again, there's a sad and concerning story about the poor getting poorer and getting hit in the energy sector. I think that is the main point for this audience that I would make, Carol.
Very good. I know you're pressed for time, so let me ask you also, Cliff Kupchan, to talk about another risk, which you call the divided states of America here in the United States. We've been witnessing that, you know, for the better part of the last decade. But talk about some of the, you know, some of the points you made there.
Yeah, first, that you and I both were heartened by the midterms, where we were really scared, we weren't alone, of a constitutional crisis in this country. The Trump tries to steal the election. Well, the Trump candidates for secretaries of state and governors in the states where he really wanted them to be elected, a lot of the swing states, Arizona, they all lost across the board. So that we think that strengthens democracy. We're not big fans of people who try to deny election outcomes. So that's the good news. The bad news is this country still remains highly polarized. And we believe with increasingly distrusted, delegitimized federal institutions, all three branches of government and the peaceful transfer of power came into question for the first time on January 6th. January 6th riots. That means that power is, we think, devolving more to the states. Look at the difference now between Texas and New York on immigration, ESG, consumer rights, labor rights. There's lots of them. These differences, the red-blue thing is growing. What that really tells you, A, is the country is getting polarized on a regional level, and B, people who want to do business here. It's really important to know what's happening in the state you're investing in. And in the 30 years I've been doing this kind of work, I never said that before with such emphasis. So that's something new and that I find both, you know, somewhat heartening, and that I think local government and regional governments, you know, come from Wisconsin, are quite capable and a really good repository of power, good place to put power. But it is worrisome in the sense that it shows just how divided this country's being has become, that we have to go to the state level to get things done. And I think given this current House of Representatives, where Speaker McCarthy is going to be very, very weak, and I don't think we'll get much at all that can be conferenced, agreed to with the Senate, and then pushed through to become law. I think this trend is really, really important.
Indeed. And I hope you can stick around just for a couple more minutes as we finish. But in terms of, you know, of the Republican Party that McCarthy now is, I guess, titular head, but yeah, particularly in the way he became speaker after an unprecedented number of votes for more than 100 years we haven't seen. So he had to make many concessions. And so this is, most analysts say, the party of Trump. And as you said, it's going to exacerbate these divides. And recently we saw the creation of a committee to investigate the weaponization of the federal government, further undermining trust in our federal institutions, which many people see as worrisome and perhaps even a waste of time. But we shall see. On the other hand, your report seems to find some bright spot in the country of India. It's the largest democracy. Now, of course, it's led by one could characterize a Hindu nationalist. But what are your thoughts regarding India as maybe a bright spot in all of this?
Projected high growth rate, 7%, 8%. It's a country that, say what you will of Modi, there's some worrisome aspects how he runs this country. It's a country on the rise. It's a country on the move. Certainly, its role in the global economy. I think the big question on India is when and if it will become more active as a geopolitical player. India is kind of in a shell. If Russia punches above its weight, it's a weak economy, but a huge geopolitical player. Until this war, I think they just disappear after the war. India punches below its weight. Second largest, about to be the largest population on Earth. Maybe it's the largest already, I think. And a very, very vibrant economy, but you know, a middle power in many ways, a diplomatic scene. The good question I have is whether that will change anytime soon. But India is a relative bright spot simply because it's just so dynamic domestically.
And one wonders, maybe could it provide some counterweight to China? Or sorry, could it provide a counterweight to Russia, in a sense, and China, but particularly Russia as it tries to continue this unlawful war in Ukraine, since they're so close?
I think Xi Jinping's the guy who's got the influence, if there is any influence to be had. Again, I don't really think there is. Mm-hmm. Modi less so. The Russians are really dependent on the Chinese for purchases of almost everything. The India relationship is close, but not as important volume-wise, size-wise, as is Russia.
And one more question as we close, Cliff. You mentioned in your report what you called red herrings. Let's talk about just a couple of those as we close. Perhaps some factors that people thought might derail this this year, but might be just overrated.
Western support for Ukraine. It's strong in this country. McConnell's held the Senate of the Republican Party behind the war, I think. The EU will moan about no peace plan, but I think they will defer to Washington and Kyiv in the end on any move or not towards a peace plan. So I think political support for the war is a red herring. It's strong. EU dysfunction. There's no queen of Europe. Angela Merkel's gone. Scholz, Macron, distracted by domestic issues. Draghi's gone too. But the EU has become stronger through the pandemic, through the war, fiscal policy, energy policy, defense policy. The EU is stronger than ever. So Europe is just fine. Thank you. And the last one has to do with Taiwan, which is an issue that gets lots of ink in my town of Washington, D.C. Everybody wants to write about China invading Taiwan. For 2023, at least, and for the medium term, I think we think that that's a red herring, that the costs are too high. Xi Jinping has built a world power, one of the two leading world powers, and to risk his markets around the world, certainly in Europe, over grabbing Taiwan too much. And, you know, secondly, China is very dependent on second tier, because they can't get first tier because they're U.S. sanctions, computer chips made by TSMC in Taiwan. They're not going to roll through the country and destroy that factory because it would bring a lot of their tech industry down. So that is a quick walk around the block of our top pairings, Carol.
Cliff Kupchan is chairman of the Eurasia Group and co-author of the firm's recent report on the top risks of 2023. Cliff Kupchan, thank you so much for your unique insights. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And before we close, I'm happy to share an editorial from the U.S. government about a topic Cliff and I discussed, the need to uplift women and girls who have been disproportionately affected by the COVID pandemic.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Can the world's most pressing problems be solved without the full participation of half its population? The answer from the United States is a resounding no, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted at the launch of the first ever U.S. strategy on global women's economic security.
We need women's full economic participation to actually lead an inclusive recovery from the COVID pandemic. As you've heard, we need their leadership in resolving conflict. We need their ideas and their innovation to tackle the climate crisis.
Secretary Blinken said the new U.S. strategy has at its heart a simple vision, creating a world in which women and girls everywhere can contribute to and benefit from economic growth and prosperity.
That's a world in which we will all be better off. Closing the gender gap in the workforce by 2025 would add up to $28 trillion to the global economy.
However, barriers to women's full economic participation, social, legal, and financial, stand in the way. Secretary Blinken outlined four lines of effort the United States will undertake.
First, we will advance women's economic competitiveness so that more women can fully participate and lead in all sectors and all industries, including as CEOs and board members.
The second line of effort will be to strengthen foundational support, childcare, elder care, that allows women to participate fully in the economy. The third line will be to promote women's entrepreneurship and financial and digital inclusion. And finally, the United States will work to help dismantle systemic barriers to women's equitable participation in the economy. The United States will encourage nations to repeal discriminatory laws and advocate for reforms that promote gender equality. Across each of these lines of effort, we will work in tandem with partners around the world, he said. Promoting women's economic security is the right thing to do, but it's also the smart and necessary thing to do, declared Secretary Blinken. When everyone can contribute to their full potential, our economies are more prosperous, our societies are more full of opportunity, our nations are more peaceful, and everyone is better off.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.